Chapter 50. The Taglian Territories. The Palace. The Taglian field army slowly assembled astride the rock road in lightly settled country midway between Dejagere and the fortified crossings over the River Main at Goja. Another, less powerful force, consisting of troops from the southern provinces, assembled outside Dejagere, and a third gathered outside Taglios itself. There seemed no reason to suspect that the force at Dejagere should have any trouble denying that city to a force such as that the Black Company was bringing up. Mogaba expected his enemies to swing west once they descended from the highlands, possibly marching as far as the Nagir River, which they could follow north, then swing eastward again and try to get over the main at one of the lesser downriver crossings. He intended to let them march and march and wear themselves down. He intended to let them do whatever they wanted till he slammed the door shut behind them. Once he had them north of the main, he could build a ring around them and slowly squeeze. The great general was feeling quite positive. Taglios was restive, but not rebellious. Even the most remote garrison commanders were bringing their soldiers to the assembly points with their units at near strength, even though some harvesting would commence in the far south before the end of the month. Harvest season inevitably precipitated higher desertion rates. Best of all, the Protector was staying away. Her tinkering and interference always made his task more difficult, and of course it was always his fault when a bastardized plan fell apart. The great general gathered his senior staff and inner circle, which included a dozen generals, as well as Gopal and Aridatha Singh. He told them, "The plan appears to be coming together perfectly. With a couple of nudges and timed withdrawals, I think we can lead them to the ford at Vednabota. I still wish we had better communications with the Protector, but she can't find enough crows anymore. Some plague is wiping them out. I seldom hear from her more than once a day, and then, often as not, she'll waste time on weather news or a flu epidemic in Prebelbed." Nor were there any shadows about, nor any of the Protector's lesser spies. Mogaba did not mention that. Taglians were dedicated conspirators. Let them continue to think that there might be eyes in the corners, watching. Only his own conspiracy need go forward. The great general had more to preoccupy him than how to isolate and destroy his enemy. He suspected there was a definite question about the identity of Taglios's most dangerous foe. Something about this incarnation of the Black Company had Soulcatcher so concerned that she insisted on focusing all her attention there. Something about this incarnation of the Black Company had touched almost everyone of substance within the Taglian Empire, though news of their return had barely had time to spread, and there were no eyewitness reports available at all. All customary enmity and internal friction seemed to be dwindling at a time when normally factionalism should be exploding, as old antagonists tried to use the situation to their advantage. And Mogaba had found that he was thinking less and less about the practicalities of eliminating the Protector, more and more obsessively about destroying the Black Company. Not just defeating them, but obliterating them. To the last man, woman, child, horse, mule, flea, and louse. After decades of unhappy fortune, Mogaba was naturally wary of everything, including his own emotional state. He had begun keeping a personal journal the day he had made the decision to betray Soulcatcher, to track his thoughts and emotions during the subsequent stressful days. It was a journal he opened only in brilliant sunlight. It was a journal he would destroy before actually taking action against the Protector, because there were names in it he did not want betrayed if he failed, and was lucky enough to die before she captured him. Lately he had noticed an evolution in his thinking about the company, an accelerating evolution, a frightening evolution. He had become suspicious of his own reason. Following a general meeting to consider policy for the Empire, the great general met with the men responsible for the capital city.
"Kina is active again," Mogaba murmured. Gopal and Aridatha listened politely.
He was referencing events from before their time, that they knew only by repute.
"She's doing that thing where she gradually shapes everyone's prejudices." They offered him blank looks. "Not history buffs, eh?" Mogaba explained. "The strangest part was, nobody ever wondered why they were terrified. They just didn't remember that 3 years earlier they'd never heard of the Black Company."
Gopal said, "What you're saying is, the Strangler Goddess has a particular fear of the Black Company. She wants the whole world to climb over them and destroy them, even if blood has to be spilled."
"Isn't this an interesting quandary?" Haridatha said. "If we can overcome the Black Company, we'll still have to deal with the Protector. If we knock her down too, then we'll still have to handle the Stranglers and Kina in order to prevent the Year of the Skulls. Wave after wave, no end to it."
"No end to it," Mogaba agreed. "And I'm getting to be quite an old man."
He had begun to nurture an outrageous notion almost as soon as he had determined that he was being manipulated.
"There are a couple of old records I want to check. I want you both back here same time tomorrow."
The great general did not lack courage. The next evening he led Gopal and Haridatha into the brightly lit room. He presented a more convincing case for his belief that Kina had awakened, drawing heavily upon excerpts from copies of Black Company annals residing in the National Library. Haridatha Singh said, "I believe you. I just wonder what happened to wake her up again."
"Gopal?" "I'm not sure I understand, but I don't think I have to. Haridatha does. I trust his wisdom."
"Then I'll talk to Haridatha, but you listen," Mogaba chuckled.
Haridatha listened to his idea, the reasoning behind it, frowning all the while. Gopal seemed aghast, but he kept his mouth shut. Haridatha went off alone with his thoughts. After a while, he nodded reluctantly and said, "I have a brother in Dejagore. I'll find a reason to go visit. I know some people who might listen to what you have to say, if it's me doing the talking."
"What?"
Haridatha said. "You recall a few years ago when the company underground here started kidnapping people. Willow Swan, the Purohita, and so on? I was one of the people they snatched." Gopal wanted to know why, and Mogaba wondered how he had gotten away. "I got away because they let me go. They only picked me up because they wanted to show me off to somebody they were holding already." Haridatha took a long, deep breath and revealed his great secret. "My father, Narayan Singh. They were showing him their power."
"Narayan Singh? The Narayan Singh? The Strangler?" Gopal asked.
"That Narayan Singh? I didn't know. Not till then. Our mother told us our father was dead. She believed it, I think. The Shadow Masters conscripted him into their labor battalions during their first invasion, before the Black Company ever arrived from the north. I was the youngest of four children. I'm pretty sure the older ones knew the truth. My brother Sugriva moved to Dejagore and changed his name. My sister Kaditya changed hers too. Her husband would die of mortification if he knew."
"You've never mentioned this before. I think you can understand why." "Oh, I do. That's a cruel burden to bear."
Mogaba already found himself responding to the deceiver connection, with exactly the sort of paranoid fear everyone did to any deceiver connection. It was inevitable. Aloud, he said,
"I wonder how those people ever trust each other."
Haridatha replied, "I suspect you'd have to be inside and a part of it all to understand. I think the biggest part of it, though, would be their faith in their goddess." The great general looked at Gopal Singh.
"If the Greys have objections, I need to hear them now."
Gopal shook his head.
"Only one Grey is going to know about this, for now. The others wouldn't understand."
"Haridatha, you have someone you trust to take charge while you're gone."
The city battalions did not know they were part of a conspiracy to free Taglios from its protector. It was necessary to keep firm control there. "Yes,
but no one in the know. If you have unusual requests, you'll have to justify them based on what's going on in the city. The soldiers understood that their role was to keep the peace if the population became too restive for the Greys alone.
Mogava asked, "Are there enough provocations to make any excuses sound good?"
Gopal showed a large array of teeth. Shaddar were proud of their well-kept teeth.
"That's almost amusing. Since the news reached the street that the Black Company really is back, there's actually been less related graffiti, as though real company sympathizers don't want to risk identification, and the non-company vandals responsible for most of it suddenly don't want to be identified with any terror that's for real."
"Terror?
You were right, what you said last night. There's a growing fear of the company out there, like you said it was in olden times. I don't understand, but it's helping keep the peace just when I expected a lot more trouble."
"If you need provocations, and the villains don't provide them, feel free to create your own. Aridatha, you know what needs doing. Do it, as quickly as possible, before events move so fast they rob us of more chances." Though it could happen almost momentarily, Mogaba had abandoned any real hope of catching the Protector unaware as she returned to the city. At the moment it seemed she did not plan to return until the Black Company invasion was settled.
Chapter 51 The Taglian Territories The Middle Ground Soulcatcher, in full leather and fuller ire, stalked the perimeter of the encampment midway between Goja and Dejagare. A dozen frightened officers followed, each silently appealing for mercy to his choice of god or gods. The Protector in a rage was a disaster no one wanted to experience. Her excesses made no more sense than do those of a tornado.
"They haven't moved. For 6 days now they've hardly taken a step. After hurtling northward like the storm itself, so fast we were killing ourselves trying to pull something together fast enough to stop them. What are they doing? What changed suddenly?"
As always when she was under stress, Soulcatcher was a babble of conflicting voices. That added to the uneasiness of the men tagging after her. None had had any experience with her before her arrival in camp. The actuality was more unnerving than the stories predicted. She seemed every bit as cruel and capricious as any god. Several graves beyond the perimeter attested to the violence of her temper. These sycophants would never find out, but those who died had been chosen only after extended supernatural espionage. Not one had been a devoted servant of the Protectorate. Each had said so aloud. Additionally, none had been particularly competent leaders, and that had been clear to their soldiers and compatriots. They had attained their positions through nepotism or cronyism, not ability. Soulcatcher was culling her officer corps. She was disappointed that necessity prevented her from doing more. That corps was terrible, but she would take no responsibility for that, of course. How poor would it have been without the efforts of the great general? Probably an awful, corrupt joke, without a punchline. Without Mogaba's dedicated nurturing, there would have been little to assemble here. How to keep it here? The desertion rate was supportable now, but showing signs of rising. Was that the enemy strategy? Wait until the Taglian armies melted because of the demands of the approaching harvest. Would they charge north again then? It sounded like a Black Company sort of thing to do. Indications were they had the wealth to maintain a force in the field a long time. Mogaba's messages indicated his own suspicions concerning a similar strategy. He was tailoring his own approach toward getting his enemy to take the long way around into a trap. Soulcatcher did not believe there would be any chance to trap the Black Company. Their intelligence resources were much too wonderful, while her own continued to fade. All species of crows were becoming endangered. Mice, bats, rats, owls, those sorts of creatures had no range. There seemed to be no modern sources of quality crystal or worthy mercury with which to create a scrying glass or bowl.
The shadows she still controlled were few and feeble and frightened, and she refused to risk them in enemy territory, often because each time she did, a few more would not come back. And for now, she was cut off from her only source of replacements. She glanced skyward, saw vultures circling to the north, over woods which ran from right to left for as far as she could see. The growth followed a shallow stream. Her sister had won a small victory over the Shadow Masters there, ages ago, soon after the Black Company had suffered the disaster that led to the siege of Dejagere.
"I'm going to walk up there and see what those vultures find so interesting."
No one gave in to the urge to protest. Maybe the vultures would dine on her.
"None of you need to come with me."
Relief was obvious. Chapter 52 The Nether Taglian Territories. Lady made grumpy noises. Lady was in a towering rage. I could not recall ever having seen her so close to losing control.
How the hell could they let that happen? Somebody was supposed to stay in that little shit's pocket every second.
No one bothered to respond. She did not want answers, not really. She wanted somebody to hurt. Tobo was quietly busy talking to things that were there only when you looked away. Big things, little things, human-looking things, and things that had escaped from madmen's nightmares. Goblin was going to be found. Goblin was going to be tracked and harassed and hurt, if at all possible, all the livelong day. Insofar as this fragment of the company was concerned, Goblin was going to be the main mission from this day forward. He was to be hunted down and exorcised, or exterminated, before he could engineer any more disasters on Kina's behalf. Though long out of practice and definitely out of the habit, Lady hurled a deadly spell at an inoffensive scrub pine. The tree began to wilt almost immediately.
"What the hell was that?" I demanded. "I thought you couldn't—"
"Be quiet. Let me think."
So astonished was Lady that she forgot to be angry about Goblin. I was quiet. I gave her all the thinking room a girl could want. Was there a silver lining inside our latest black cloud? My, at the moment, not very lucky wife called,
"Tobo, next message you send north, ask if the little shit got away with one of the gate keys, or anything else unusual."
Tobo made little gestures to the air, then replied,
"I checked on that already. He got away with nothing more than two horses and one saddle. Not even a sausage. He's probably eating bugs. The only unusual thing mentioned is that nobody noticed him, an eventuation almost certainly artificial in origin."
"Because?"
"Because he's being damned hard to notice right now. The Black Hounds shouldn't be having any trouble finding and following him, but they are. He's as elusive as a ghost. Each time they do make contact, it's because he's been following the road without deviating, and they can just wait for him to show up."
"Following the road? Where?"
"North, toward the junction with the Rock Road. Though because he isn't talking, his plans are unclear."
Tobo still had a sense of humor about what was going on. I asked Lady, "How did you manage to murder that tree?" She mused.
"A good question. Without a good answer. I never felt any sharpened Kina presence."
"You think it might have to do with Goblin? We know Kina must have put a piece of herself into him, or he wouldn't even be alive."
"I would have sensed something before, I think. Tobo, did you feel anything weird about Goblin?"
"Of course." The boy was curt. He was trying to work. Old folks kept interrupting.
"He wasn't Uncle Goblin anymore. But he wasn't any more powerful than he was before, either."
I said, "Maybe it was something that didn't come out until he got the chance to kill Narayan." Debate on the why increasingly focused on the fact that crippled old Narayan had been in no shape to run or do anything on behalf of his goddess, and, if left in our hands, would have been compelled to reveal whatever he knew, eventually. And while most of us would view his murder as a betrayal by his goddess, what we knew of Deceiver doctrine suggested that he might actually see it as a reward. Having been strangled for the goddess, Narayan would go directly to Deceiver Paradise, where,
No doubt his rewards would be commensurate with his service. I tended toward the cynical view where religion is concerned. After a silence so extended, I decided she was not listening. My beloved responded, "You might just be smarter than you look. She'd expect us to be suspicious enough to watch every breath Goblin took, so she'd want him to seem as normal as possible until he got a solid chance to get away." She began to pace. Poor Goblin. That would have been mostly him, maybe even really trying to help his old friends as much as he could. And he'll still be partly Goblin, but a prisoner inside his own body. The hollowness of her voice indicated that she might have been through that herself once upon a time. "Which tells us nothing of his purpose, or of Kina's. She's in prison. She wants out. That doesn't take any special figuring. But there'll be a grand plan. Old Goblin didn't get his soul eaten up just so he could be flung across the pond of the world like a skipping stone. He's going to go somewhere, and he's going to do something, and if he gets away with it, all the rest of us are going to end up really sorry." Lady grunted. She was still mostly angry. I said, "He headed north. What's up there that would interest Kina?" Tobo interrupted his sweet talk with his pets. "Boo-boo." He sounded as unhappy as I felt. "He's going to take Narayan's place, watching over the Daughter of Night." "Yeah. Only there'll be a big chunk of goddess in him, so he'll be a lot more dangerous than Narayan ever was." Lady glared around her with an expression that made me think she did not have much trouble seeing Tobo's friends. "Do you think my sister can be made to hear one of those?" You could have heard a stack of pans drop. Even the animals quieted down. I asked, "You have something in mind?" "Yes. We send her a message. Tell her what's going on with Goblin. It's as much in her interest to stop him as it is in ours." "And she has a personal interest," Tobo reminded us. I understood immediately, but Lady needed it explained. "Goblin is the reason Soulcatcher has a bad leg." "Oh, of course. I remember now." She ought. She was there, spying on everything through the eyes of a white crow during the kidnapping of the Radisha. That same night, Goblin managed to trick Soulcatcher into springing a booby trap. The result had been serious and irreversible damage to her right heel. Tobo said, "She gets around pretty well now. She wears a special boot and brace and is supported by several specialized spells. She only limps when she's really tired." "Ah, she'll definitely want to chat with Goblin then. She's always been a sore loser." "Just a thought," I offered. "What happens if Soulcatcher turns Goblin into her own version of the Taken? And maybe Boo-Boo, too. Word is, there were times when she showed a few powers of her own." "Make a slave out of a goddess?" Lady was incredulous. I raised an eyebrow. She protested. "What I did wasn't the same thing at all. What I did was pure parasitism. I wormed in so she couldn't get me out without hurting herself."
"And now you're getting a little of that back."
"But it doesn't feel the same. Tobo, can you send a message to my sister or not?"
"I can try. In fact, I can do it, easily. The real question would be whether or not she'd listen."
"She'll listen, or I'll kick her butt."
It took all of us a moment to realize she was joking. She did so so rarely. Tobo began concentrating on the task of getting an extended message to Soulcatcher. Again, I cautioned, "There's a risk in this." Lady just made one of her grumpy noises. She was turning into a cranky old witch.
Chapter 53. The Taglian Territories. A Haunted Wood. Soulcatcher glanced back before entering the wood.
"So where are they all?"
And in a firm male voice she demanded, "What happened to all the suck-ups?" Another voice,
"Somebody should have wanted to kiss up."
A puzzled voice asked,
"They always do, don't they?"
"Are we losing it here?"
"I don't like it." "This isn't fun anymore."
Petulant, spoiled child voice.
"Most of the time we're just going through the motions. There aren't any challenges here."
Even when there are, it's almost impossible to get impassioned enough to care.
Most of those voices were businesslike but jaded.
It's hard to keep going on fuel like hunger for revenge alone.
It's hard to be alone, period.
That remark brought on an extended silence. Soulcatcher did not have a voice for expressing the emotional costs of being who she was. Not out loud. Ferocious, mad-killer sorcerers do not whine because nobody likes them. The growth along the creek had a sharp boundary. In another time, the land must have been groomed by human occupation. Soulcatcher listened. The wood, which was a little more than a mile wide, seemed remarkably silent. There should have been a racket from work parties harvesting firewood and timber for use around the camp. But there was nothing, and she did not recall authorizing a holiday. Something had frightened the soldiers away. Yet she sensed no danger. After a moment, though, she did detect a supernatural presence. She glanced upward. Those vultures continued to circle. They were lower now. They seemed to be wheeling above the presence she sensed. Warily, she probed farther and deeper. She had remarkably well-honed senses when she cared to concentrate. This presence was like nothing in her experience, something like a powerful shadow, yet with a strong implication of working intelligence. Not a demon or some such otherworldly entity, though. Something that felt like it was a part of nature, but still having about it a hint of not belonging to this world. But how? Not of this world, but not otherworldly. Something very powerful, but not driven by malice, at the moment. Something timeless, accustomed to patience, mildly impatient right now. Again, a smart shadow thing like those stalkers down south had been. Soulcatcher extended her senses to their maximum. This thing was waiting for her alone. It had repulsed everything but those vultures. She had to be careful. Despite her ennui, she did not want to trigger a fatal ambush. There was nothing. She stepped forward. She did so while assembling a quiver of sudden and deadly spells. She squinted behind her mask, looking for this thing that wanted to see her. It grew stronger, but less focused as she moved toward it. For a moment it seemed that it was all around her, even while being in one place somewhere ahead of her. When she did arrive where her senses told her it ought to be, she saw nothing. That place was a small clearing just off the rock road, across the shallow stream. She saw several Vedna grave markers and a few Guni memorial posts with time-gnawed prayer wheels on top. This must be where her sister fought the Shadowlander cavalry during her flight from Dejagare, in a time so long ago that she still had believed Narayan Singh to be her friend and champion. Sunlight tumbled through the leaves overhead. It dappled the clearing. Soulcatcher settled on a rotten log that protruded from what might once have been an earthwork.
"I'm here. I'm waiting."
Something large moved at the edge of her vision. She got the impression of a black feline, but when she turned, she saw nothing.
"So that's the way it's going to be, eh? Thus it must be. Ever."
The response seemed to come from nowhere in particular, and it was not clear whether she heard it with her ears or inside her head.
"What do you want from me?"
Soulcatcher used a deep, masculine voice, heavy with menace. The presence was amused, not intimidated.
"I bring a message from your old friend, Croker."
Croker was no friend. In fact, she was distinctly piqued with that man. He had not been entirely cooperative when she had tried to seduce him, and now he had refused to stay buried after she had tried to kill him. Still, he was the reason she had a head on her shoulders these days, and that tiny edge would be why this communication was arriving in his name.
"Go ahead."
Though whatever it was, did as she bid. As she listened, she poked around in an effort to fathom its true nature, while searching for some handle she could grasp to make it over into an agent of her own. It sensed what she was doing. It was amused, not troubled, not frightened, not inclined to react, just amused. Soulcatcher reviewed the story carefully once the spook had finished relating it. It sounded plausible, if incomplete. But why expect those people to be entirely forthcoming in such a situation? Try as she might, she could discover no obvious trap. They sounded worried down there. This news could explain their sudden shift of strategy. Goblin possessed by Kina. Narayan Singh dead. The Daughter of Night running loose. Not running loose at all. In the hands of her troops, on the rock road, somewhere south of Dejagare, very probably looking for an opportunity to get loose. Goblin might arrange that. She bounced up off the rotten log, ennui gone.
Tell Croker he can consider communications opened. I'll take steps to deal with the situation. Go! Go!
A flicker, like a shadow passing through and deserting at the same time. It left a deeply felt chill, and one more uncertain glimpse of an impossibly large, cat-like form moving away at an impossible pace. From the nearby rock road came the rattle and clop of a large party headed south. Camels seemed to be involved. That meant civilians. There were no camels in her armies. She hated camels. They were filthy animals with nasty tempers even on their best days. She leapt across the creek and hurried to the edge of the woods, emerging not 100 feet from where a caravan was doing the same. Civilian it was, but most of the wagons and camels and mules would discharge their cargo in her camp. The caravanners spied her. They were startled and frightened. Her blood was moving again. She always enjoyed the impact she made when she appeared unexpectedly. As she turned and raised her gaze to the circling vultures, she thought she glimpsed a familiar face among the merchants and teamsters. Aridatha Singh? Here? How? Why? But when she looked more closely, she saw no Aridatha. Maybe it was just someone who looked like Singh. Maybe it was her reawakened zest reminding her that it had been a long time since she had enjoyed a man. Aridatha Singh had a definite masculine allure. Few women failed to notice that, though he seemed entirely unaware of the effect he had. Time enough to think about that after she alerted Dejagare and got troops of cavalry out to round up her niece, that willful, difficult child. There must be some way to gain control of her and add her talents to the arsenal of the Protectorate. Possibly she might even take Goblin, despite the fact of his possession. Goblin had never been much of a wizard. How sweet revenge was when it arrived after a long delay. Then let that bitch Ardath and all her dogs come on. A lot of ancient debts would get paid off. As she approached the encampment ditch, she glanced back to consider the vultures again. The carrion birds had broken their circle. Only a few remained in sight, cruising the sky in search of something rank and tasty again. Soulcatcher found a voice she had not used since she was young. With it, she began to sing a song of springtime and young love, in a language recalled from the springtime of life, when love still lived in the world. The sentries were extremely frightened. Chapter 54 The Taglian Territories The Thing in the Cesspit. "I have a question," Mergen said. The stronghold at Nija was in sight. "Who's going to tell Sleepy we're in bed with the Protector?" I replied, "I don't reckon anybody has to. Not putting it that way, anyhow." "She's a reasonable woman," Lady opined. "She'll understand what we did and why." Tobo laughed. Mergen just grinned weakly. The boy wizard said, "You must not have been paying attention, or you must have mistaken the Sleepy I know for somebody else." I told him, "She'll get over it. How's Soulcatcher doing on cutting Boo Boo off?"
"She has pickets out in a line south of Dejagare. The line keeps spreading out wider to either side of the rock road. She doesn't entirely trust me to send her solid information, and I'm not giving her everything I know because I don't want her guessing how well I can keep an eye on her. She's not talking about this to her captains, by the way.
My guess is she's afraid she'll start losing them if they begin worrying about Kina.
What a bold lot we were. When first the company arrived in the Taglian territories, a fixed part of Taglian culture was that the goddess was never named, lest her attention be attracted. If a name just had to be used, people would reference the watered-down avatar from Guni myth, Kadi. The fact that the name Kina is now widely used in daily speech is one more indication of the magnitude of the impact the company has had these past few decades. Maybe those old-timers had been right to be terrified of us. We have shaken a civilization to its foundations, and its future does not look bright. They asked for it. All we ever wanted to do was pass on through. "We won't have to deal with Sleepy for a few days yet," Tobo told us. "She's moving out of the highlands onto the plain, following the south bank of the Villawash right now. She's only moving a few miles a day. The countryside there has enough of a surplus to support her easily. She started trying to recruit, in the name of the Prabhrindra Dra. The prince and his sister are showing themselves off. I had a feeling they would not sell well in those parts. That was territory that had been conquered by the Black Company in Taglios's name. What about Bubu?" "Almost up to the Protector's picket line now, sticking to the rock road. The Black Hounds have instructions to make sure she gets caught." Lady grumped. "I thought she was caught already, that she was a prisoner." "That's true, but right now she seems content to have it that way. I understand that her guards aren't nearly as attentive to her security as they ought to be." Having read Sleepy's annals, I was not surprised. Bubu seemed capable of having a mind-numbing impact on nearby male-type people. "Then that's something you need to let my sister know. Otherwise, she could get a surprise that would leave all of us unhappy." We were approaching the Nijo Wall. I said, "You experts ought to give this place the once-over, see if our bitty old buddy left any evidence behind." That earned me frowns and scowls. Here came a chance to rest, and I was talking about more work. Not for me, but for them. I changed the subject and asked Lady, "You said Sleepy burned the books of the dead. The real ones. You were a direct witness." "I was a witness through the White Crow. She burned all three of them. Shivetya himself has their ashes. He's been having Baladitya dispose of them a pinch at a time by having them carried away by anyone who's traveling the plain." Tobo said, "I moved a lot of them back when Sovereign and I were exploring the plain. What's up?" "An old man's natural curiosity, I guess. Everyone, and the deceivers seem to agree, thinks the Daughter of Night, or whoever inherits her job if she fails, will have to have the books of the dead to complete the rituals of the Year of the Skulls. No books, no resurrection, right?" I did not get an answer. There was no answer anyone could give. In actual fact, nobody really knew. Possibly not even my befuddled daughter or poor old deceiver and now very dead Narayan Singh. Lady stipulated, "The old witch is still in there trying, isn't she?" "Isn't she?" Lady and Tobo found nothing of interest at the Nija post. Goblin had not shed his skin or left any secret deceiver hex signs. He had just started running while the getting was good, as soon as somebody realized that he might be responsible for Narayan's murder. Uncle Doge rejoined us at Nija. So did some stragglers who had accumulated there. Sleepy would not have much trouble with desertions. These men knew no one outside the company and spoke not a word of Taglian or any other local language. With the stragglers added, we would number more than 100 when we resumed traveling. Of the original group, we lacked only Spook and Pandaman, who had been awarded the dubious honor of staying behind to watch the Shadow Gate. Once finished looking for other evidence, Lady cornered Doge. "Where's the body?" "Huh?" The old swordmaster was baffled. "Narayan Singh, what did you do with his corpse?" Tobo and I exchanged looks. That question had not occurred to either of us. It might be a good idea to make doubly certain just who had died.
Narayan Singh had been a veritable prince of deceivers, beloved of Kina. One of the injured men left to garrison Nija volunteered. "They threw him in the old cesspit, then filled it with dirt and rock from the new latrine, ma'am, which was built according to your specifications, sir."
"I have had a reputation as a martinet along those lines ever since I joined the company. And when health, hygiene, and waste disposal are handled my way, the company tends to experience significantly fewer disease problems than do people who do not do things my way. It remains impossible to reason with some men, though, so I just give orders and make sure they are carried out."
"Dig him up," Lady directed.
And when nobody rushed to grab up picks and shovels, she began to glow darkly and swell up and even to develop fangs. Then people started looking for tools.
"That was interesting," I told her.
"Been working on it since I ambushed myself in that tree. It doesn't take much effort or power, but it ought to be visually impressive."
"It definitely was that."
The exhumation satisfied Lady. There was a body. It resembled Narayan Singh, even including his bad leg. And it was unnaturally well-preserved, considering where it had been buried. "Well," I asked after she had gone so far as to open the body up. I do not know what she expected to find.
"It does seem to be him. Considering who he served, who seemed to love him, I was almost certain there wouldn't be a body, or it wouldn't be Narayan's if there was."
The truth was, she had not wanted it to be Narayan. She did not want Singh evading her vengeance this easily. "There's no dramatic unity in real life," I told her. "Save it up and take it out on Goblin." She offered me a wicked look. "I mean on the thing that's taken possession of Goblin. The real Goblin would be my oldest surviving friend." She carved Narayan's corpse into little pieces. She left a trail of those for the bugs and buzzards over the next several days. But the man's head, heart, and hands she kept in a jar of pickling brine. I did not ask why or if she had a plan. Narayan's escape had left her in much too black a mood for small talk. A couple of times I did overhear her cursing the fact that there were no great necromancers left in the world. She would call Narayan back from paradise or hell to make him pay for taking our daughter. The smaller Vorosh girl, the captive, came out to see us. In not bad Taglian, she told us,
"Sedvad just died."
She stared at Tobo the whole time. I went to check. The sick boy had indeed passed on, and I still had no idea why. I figured the goblin thing probably deserved the blame. Chapter 55. The Nether Taglian Territories. Along the Villawash. Sleepy surprised us all. She was irked about us dealing with Soulcatcher, but she made no great fuss. "This situation isn't the one I prepared for. Tobo, I trust you're taking steps to prevent the Protector from observing what we're doing."
"She sees what we want her to see,
which means she doesn't see what we're doing, only what our mutual enemies are doing." Which was not much on Boo-Boo's part. Despite her best efforts to vanish during the night after her captors first encountered Soulcatcher's pickets, she remained a captive. She would be turned over to Soulcatcher herself within a few days. Goblin, moving faster than the girl's captors were, had been gaining ground fast, and Tobo now placed him only about 30 miles behind. I suggested that he would be more trouble to Soulcatcher than Boo-Boo ever could. Thinking out loud, I said, "I wonder if this is how myths get started." People looked at me like they were not sure they wanted to know what that was all about. I explained, "Here we've got a bunch of people visiting strange places most people couldn't get to even if they wanted. We've got close relatives squabbling and even trying to murder each other."
"That's reaching," Mergen said.
"I like it," Tobo said. "A 1,000 years from now they'll remember me as the God of Storms, or something."
"Or something?" his father asked.
"How about the small god who makes littler rocks out of runty stones?"
Earlier, Tobo had gotten caught making stones explode. He had been doing it for the sheer joy of watching them shatter and hearing the fragments ricochet. He was embarrassed, but you have got to have fun once in a while. Today's company is not nearly as much fun as it was when I was young. I snickered. We marched 40 miles every day, uphill all the way, in the snow, when we weren't in the swamp.
What?
Thought I'd start practicing for when I get really old.
How do you make rocks explode?
Oh, that's easy. You just kind of feel what they're like inside. You find the water. You make it hot enough, and the rock goes boom.
Find the water inside a rock, and the rock goes boom.
Right. I had to ask. I changed the subject. How are those Voroshk kids doing? Despite everything he had to do, Tobo found time to spend with our captives. It was amazing how much the kid could handle in a day. I could recall when life worked that way for me, back when we were marching up all those hills with cold, wet feet.
Uncle Doge has them speaking Taglian like they were born in the Delta, in the shadow of the temple at Gangesha.
Excellent. He was poking fun, of course.
They're picking up the language. Shukrat and Magadan could get by now. Arcana is having trouble, but she's catching on. None of them are mourning Sedvad. Gromovol, the brother, is being stubborn. He doesn't like not being the only conduit. He likes to be in control of something, but even he is making progress.
Gromovol is the pain in the ass, then. Which are which with the other names? I haven't heard any names before.
That's because they hadn't given up hope that their family would rescue them from their own dumb mistake. Even more than the Guni do, they believe their names can be used against them. There's a connection with their souls.
Which means that Shukrat and Magadan and whatnot won't actually be real names.
They're real public names, work names, just not true names.
I've never understood the concept, but it's one I've learned to live with.
Which one is which?
Shukrat is the shorter girl, the one who crashed.
The one who's working up a crush on you.
Tobo ignored me. The ability to ignore seems to be coupled with a talent for sorcery.
Arcana is the ice queen, which I definitely would not mind melting. Magadan is the quiet guy.
Magadan, in my estimation, would be the dangerous one, if he so chose. He observed and studied and prepared. He did not bluster or invoke the threat of powers from a world away.
Did you tell them what happened at the Shadow Gate?
They didn't want to believe me, but they did enough to decide to introduce themselves, enough to conclude that they're likely to be a part of our world for a long time to come.
You did remind them that that's what they asked for.
Sure. Shukrat even managed to joke about it. She has a great sense of humor, for a girl, who didn't ask to be here.
Considering the females in his experience, I could see how he might think a feeble sense of humor was a sex-linked characteristic.
Only Iqbal Singh's wife ever smiled and joked, and Suruvija's lot was the poorest of all the women associated with the company.
But all you can see is long legs, long blonde hair, big blue eyes, and a monumental set of gazumbis.
Once we got up into settled country, we needed to find the kid a whore, 20 years old and never been laid.
On the other hand, harnessing all that energy the way we were right now had a lot to recommend it.
We were not headed into an era where we could let our most talented wizard be distracted by nature.
Maybe we should find him a traveling companion. I could just imagine what his mother would say about that.
The future, I said, raising my hand as though holding a drink.
We have to get Swan and Blade set up in the brewing business.
Mergen said, that's what I miss most about One Eye, too.
Here's a thought. Maybe Goblin will get so thirsty he'll shake Kina off and set up a still.
I had to mention Goblin. That took the pleasure out of the moment.
Everybody who remembered the old goblin had to deal with those memories each time the man's name came up.
Those memories were going to be treacherous if we ever confronted the Revenant himself, even if they caused just a moment's hesitation. If we had to go after Goblin Hard, we would be better served to send people from Sien. They would not be sentimental about him. Their exposure was entirely hearsay. I did not want to hasten the day. I asked, "Tobo, now that we've slowed down, what are we going to do about the Howler?" An entire infantry company had been saddled with that sleeping sorcerer from the day he and Long Shadow had been brought up out of the earth. That company had no other duties but transporting and protecting the Howler. Something's got to be. If she don't wake him up and make a deal, we'd better kill him, before Soulcatcher figures out that we've got him and steals him so she can use him herself. I was worried that Sleepy was not taking the Howler seriously enough. She had no experience of him, not enough to understand just how dangerous he could be, which was just as dangerous as Soulcatcher, and he was crazier than she was. The Howler was no dedicated enemy of ours, though he had worked against us far more often than otherwise. His nature seemed to make him a follower. He gravitated toward where the strength seemed to be. He was so powerful, I would prefer he was with us rather than not. Or, if not with us, dead.
There's a certain amount of debate. Sleepy would rather just leave him for the jackals. Mom would, too, only she keeps having these premonitions. You know how big premonitions are with the women of the Key family.
One got your mom and dad together.
No use crying over spilled milk, Willow Swan said. How about somebody tell Sleepy if she's not going anywhere in a hurry, why don't we set down in one place? It's a pain to set up and tear down every day if we're not going anywhere.
Our northward drift did allow for a lot of camp time. I used it to work on these annals. Lady used it to get several wagon loads of large bamboo poles collected so she could begin manufacturing a new generation of fireball projectors. Tobo used it to teach the Varashk youngsters. I joined him occasionally. The boy Magadan seemed to have a healing touch. We needed to nurture that. Arcana remained the Ice Queen. Shukrat grew more relaxed with us. And Gromoval decided he wanted to become my buddy, in support of whatever scheme was shaping up inside of him. Although he did not spread it around, Tobo figured out the basics of riding the Varashk flying post, at least a particular flying post. I suspect Shukrat helped him. It was her post he sneaked out in the middle of the night, indulging all of a young man's joy in adventure. Chapter 56 The Nether Taglian Territories. The Manor at Garhani's. 10 days into the amble on the Villawash, we had traveled barely 45 miles. A third of those we covered in a single day, when it became apparent, to the amazement of all, that there really were people in the Taglian territories disinclined to celebrate liberation from the Protector's reign. A coalition of regional nobles and priests tried to resist, then tried to hole up in a stout manor called Garhani's. In the field, Tobo used his talents to weaken their will to resist, before the soldiers got a real chance to beat up on them. We surrounded the manor at dusk. Fires sprouted. The outer wall of the manor house seemed to boil with a dark mist as the unknown shadows stormed the place. Results did not become obvious for hours. Tobo's friends preferred to be indirect, and preferred the cover of darkness. We had the place surrounded. Our bonfires sent harmless shadows scampering over the manor walls. I told Sleepy, "The place looks nice and comfy, Captain. We're in no hurry. We could hang around here for a while, long enough to learn its name." She was underwhelmed by the suggestion. "Garhani's. Bless you. Garhani's is the name of the place, you idiot. And it's the best place we've seen. Maybe we should set up the prince and his sister here, sort of get them back into the swing of being royalty. The gods knew they got no practice with us savages. We just dragged them hither and yon like so much duffel, in case they became useful someday."
"Don't you have some writing to do,
or a boil to Lance?
Not at the moment. I'm all yours and full of advice. Before she could put together a suitable reply without using profanity, a party of several men slipped out of the manor, bringing women and children with them. I had a feeling our camp looked pretty impressive. It was supposed to look like a horde was on the move. Tobo and his parents materialized. The boy said, "The haunts are working faster than I thought they would." He extended an arm, hand, palm, downward, then whispered in what sounded like the language of Sien. A moment later, a cry of rage came from a high manor window where a pair of archers had been about to snipe at the defectors. One somehow managed to fall through the opening. The captain said, "Have those things start whispering that anyone who surrenders before dawn will be allowed to take their possessions with them. They'll even be allowed to go home unharmed if they take an oath to the Prabhrindra Dra. Captives taken after sunrise tomorrow will be conscripted into our forced labor battalions." We did not have forced labor battalions, but those were a part of siege warfare and were often the fate of prisoners of war and peasants who were insufficiently fleet of foot. The threat was plausible, and the Black Company had a long reputation for being unimpressed by caste, noble birth, or priestly status, too. Once it was clear we would provide covering fire to defectors, a flow developed. Usually the soldiers set to keep deserters from using the posterns were the first to come over. The people engineering the resistance were not popular with their conscripted followers. So some folks wanted to see the protectorate continue, but the people who had to do the work were not interested. The few I got to talk to had no real convictions in the matter. Who ruled made little difference in their lives, but it was getting on toward harvest time. One of the great truths was getting some exposure to the light here. Our men entered the manor early next morning. I was still asleep. Tobo's pets spread confusion. Our men cleaned up behind them. None of our people died. There were few wounds of any consequence. Sleepy felt magnanimous. She turned most of the men of standing over to the Radisha and her brother for judgment. Only those Tobo identified as irredeemable creatures of the Protector faced the company justice. "Spread that around," Sleepy told Tobo. "Make it sound a lot bigger than it was." "Tonight, little people will be whispering in the ears of sleepers everywhere, within 200 miles. Chapter 57 The Nether Taglian Territories. The Resurrection. That far Taglian province shared religions with the rest of the Taglian territories, with the majority being Guni. Its language was closely akin to that spoken around Dejagore. Sleepy could manage the dialect with only a little practice. What I called a manor house was really more like a village, completely enclosed within a single blockish structure. The principal building material was an unbaked brick kept carefully plastered so it would not wash away in the rain. Inside, there was an open central square with both cisterns and a good well. Stables and workshops opened on it all around. The rest of the structure was a warren of halls and rooms where people obviously lived and worked and ran shops and lived life as though the place was indeed some sort of city. "It's a termite mound," Mergen told me. "The prince and his sis ought to feel right at home. It's as bad as the Taglian Palace on a miniature scale." "I want to know what they ate. The smell is overpowering." The odors of spices clogged every hallway. But that was true in every Taglian city and town. These odors were just an alien mix. Tide caught up. He had actually allowed Mergen out of his sight for several minutes. Maybe he was slowing down, too. He brought a message. "Tobo says to tell you that Sleepy has decided to take a chance on wakening the Howler." You could tell Tide was worried, because that was one of the longest speeches I ever heard the man make. Sleepy chose to undertake the awakening with full pomp, ceremony, and drama.
Following an evening meal, we gathered in what had been a temple hall, when everyone was rested, well-fed, and supposedly relaxed. The place of worship was poorly lit, and boasted far too many multi-headed and multi-armed idols in its corners to lead me to consider it strictly benign. None of the idols represented Kadi, but all Guni deities make me uncomfortable. I was present in a demigod role myself. I appeared as the creepy armored monster Widowmaker. I do not enjoy the role. My dearly beloved, on the other hand, just loves any excuse to assume the guise of life-taker. For a few hours she can wear the ugly armor and pretend that these are still the good old days, when she was something much more wicked than this life-taker thing is supposed to be now. Our role in the proceeding was to sit there in the gloom with colorful worms of sorcery slithering over us. We were supposed to look intimidating while others got the real work done. Tobo just came as Tobo. Hell, he did not bother putting on a clean shirt and trousers. But he did bring his Varoshk students. The rest of the audience consisted of senior officers and regional notables who had come in mainly to assess the Prabhrindra Dra and to discover what they would need to do to weather our presence. Conquerors do come and go. The hall was crowded. All those bodies produced a lot of heat, and I was inside that armor, sitting motionless on a stool behind the action, One Eye's black spear held upright in my right hand. That was supposed to be my entire part. It mostly involved not fainting in front of witnesses. Sleepy had set the stage pretty well, with the low lighting and enough advance rumor-mongering to make the audience understand that the Howler was both foaming-mouth mad and yet a sorcerer who was as powerful as the Protector. Poor Howler. Despite his part in the Shadowmaster Wars, he was almost forgotten now. The Varoshk, I noted, eventually settled right up front. Tobo was treating them as good friends, particularly the well-rounded, freckled little blonde. He chattered with her until Sleepy growled and told him to get on with it. Even I felt a little let down by the awakening. Tobo indulged in no mumbo-jumbo and no showmanship. He felt that his part was no more exciting than working in a stable. But his effort was more impressive to thoughtful minds. A few people, maybe the right people, understood that Tobo was so good he could make something big look routine. I thought the boy's effort said a lot about his character, too. His ego did not need a lot of feeding. I noted that 3 out of 4 Varoshk got it right away. Gromoval actually got it too, but he did have an ego disease. Tobo freed Howler from his long trance in a matter of minutes. I do not know the whole story. You never do with their kind of people. But I do know that Howler is ages older even than Lady. He was one of the men who helped her first husband, the Dominator, build the Domination, an empire that collapsed into the northern dust about the time the original Black Company crossed over from Katovar. Howler's pain and deformity are a legacy of that time. So is the kind of thinking that led Soulcatcher to proclaim herself Protector. The woman does not have the obsessive focus and drive necessary to create a true replica of that old empire of darkness. I never have seen Howler outside the layered rags he wears, rags so long unchanged that a whole ecology has developed between the Howler's skin and the surrounding world. It includes numerous invertebrates, molds, mildews, and a variety of small green plants. The Howler is smaller than Goblin or One Eye ever were, but Lady insists that that was not always the case. When Tobo finished, the almost shapeless little ragbag sucked in a deep breath, then let out one of the shrieks that had given him his name. It seemed an egalitarian mix of agony and despair. I shivered despite the heat. It had been a long time since I had heard one of those cries. I could have waited a lot longer to hear this one. The little wizard sat up. Swords made metallic sounds, spearheads dropped,
Several of the half-dozen existing new-production fireball projectors swung to point Howler's way. But he did nothing more. He was at least as disoriented as the worst of the rest of us when he awakened. Tobo signaled. A man stepped forward with a pitcher of water. Howler would be fiercely thirsty. He would drink as much as he was allowed for the next couple of days. The first few of us to be awakened 4 years ago had made ourselves sick drinking too much water. We learned to ration. Howler wanted water by the gallon, too. He did not get it. He opened his mouth. A terrible howl came out. He could not control that frightful habit. As rationality returned, the little wizard looked around and was not pleased with his situation. He did not recognize anyone immediately. He asked, "How long has it been?" He used a tongue of the north so ancient no one but Lady spoke it. She translated into the language of Xian, adding, "Right now he thinks he's been resurrected into a whole new age." I suggested, "Break his heart fast. We don't have time to waste." Howler asked questions again, in a series of languages, trying to elicit an understandable response. I watched him wilt as he began to acknowledge the possibility that he had been asleep so long that the nations of his own age had been forgotten. But he was not entirely numb mentally. Though they differed in detail from the originals, he soon recognized the armor Lady and I wore, and recalled who was who. He addressed himself to Lifetaker. The language he chose was an old one that they had shared in another age. There had been a time when I could read it, written, but could only guess at the meaning of the spoken words. Just when everyone started to relax, he let rip another bone-chilling shriek. Lady announced, "Howler sees the general situation. Once he's had a little more explained, I think he'll be amenable to an alliance." I used the language of Xian to respond. "Howler has been part of my life most of my life, and all that time he's been one of the people trying to kill me. I don't think I can be real comfortable having him on my side."
"Well, that would be stupid, wouldn't it? We don't have to trust him, darling. The unknown shadows will keep him trustworthy."
"Of course. And you do remember his true name, which you could pass along to Tobo."
"If I have to."
I nodded, thinking it might be a damned good idea for her to tell Tobo right away, because the Howler was not the sort to be shy, reluctant, or slow about eliminating a threat. Howler let rip another terrible cry. Sleepy had begun to simmer because she did not know what was going on. Lady talked to the Howler about our situation while I told the captain what was going on. The Howler howled. There was some passion in this cry. He did not like the situation at all, but he had been there before, and my sweetie was amply blunt in making it clear that there would be only one other choice available. One reason the Howler had become the Howler was his powerful aversion to death. Nor did he have any reason to love Soulcatcher, who had buried him in a hope that that would last forever, and who had played him cruelly a time or two farther in the past. The little sorcerer howled again. In the language of Xian, I wondered aloud, "Tobo, do you think Shivetya has the power to cure this little shit screaming?" It really got distracting after a while. Tobo shrugged. "Possibly." He was not paying much attention. "I can find out." He was trying to hear what Riverwalker was whispering to Sleepy. Riverwalker had been called away a few minutes earlier. He was back now with Sovereign and a cavalry officer named T. Nung. Nung's troop was supposed to have picket duty, so I supposed something important had happened out there. Sleepy nodded, said something affirmative. Riverwalker, Sovereign, and T-Nung withdrew. Sleepy started to snap something at them, but whatever the thought was, it had come too late. Sleepy shifted her attention back to the matter at hand. She seemed less than totally focused now. She had developed a case of the fidgets, and she seemed to have brightened up.
She leaned over to confide something to Sara. Sara was startled. Then she became smiley and conspiratorial, possibly even teasing. The captain did appear to be embarrassed. Lady coughed indiscreetly to cue me that it was Widowmaker's turn to speak to our leader. So I said, "Captain, the Howler would be honored to throw in his lot with the Black Company. He'll create flying carpets for us, and he'll help with our weapons program. I wouldn't trust him a whole hell of a lot, though, and I'd keep him away from the Voroshk." All this stated in the language of Sien, so the little sorcerer would not follow. The youngsters remained in their unhappy clump, trying to understand. Almost perky little Shukrat understood enough Taglian already to keep her companions accurately posted as to what got said in that language. Riverwalker and Sovereign returned. A tall, handsome man accompanied them. He was dusty and obviously exhausted, but he was alert. He ran an inquisitive eye over everyone. He seemed to recognize several people. He even bowed slightly to the Radisha. Sleepy rose to greet him. There was a deference in her manner I had not seen before, though it was so subtle as to lurk on the border of imagination. Obviously this was someone she knew, but not someone she cared to announce. After a tentative clasping of hands, she, Sara, Riverwalker, and a few others, including the Radisha, slipped away. I wondered immediately if they had not done something stupid by bringing the man into a crowded hall when a meeting with him needed to be private. Yet a glance around showed me nobody buzzing, excepting Sleepy's cronies from her years underground in Taglios. Might the visitor be some company brother who had been left behind, or some past ally? The glance around also showed me all the Goonie idols apparently stirring. That had begun to divert the attention of the audience. Tobo was grim with concentration. He had his spectral allies hard at work. That pretty boy had to be somebody special. A moment later, Widowmaker moved for the first time during the festivities. He stood up suddenly. The tip of his spear snapped down, pricked the rags surrounding the Howler, who had managed to stifle his screams and was in the process of beginning to ooze away. Lifetaker's great black sword fell an instant later, blocking his line of sight. Chapter 58 Garhonis, the Traitor General. It was deep in the night when a limping Run-Must-Sing dragged me out of bed, out of a real bed. It had been ages, and this one came with a real woman in it. Run-Must insisted that she had to get up, too. The captain wanted us both. Lady was grumbling something about restructuring the chain of command when we left our cubicle. We ran into Mergen right away. He was waiting for Tydei, who had not gotten a personalized wake-up call. Sara was nowhere in sight. I asked, "When are you two going to work it out so you can go your own ways?" Tydei was one of very few Nuang Bao still dedicating himself to bodyguarding. "I don't think that'll happen," Mergen said. "He doesn't have anything else since Narayan died." Ah. Tydei's son had been slain by stranglers. Tydei was another who had been waiting in line to get some paybacks. The obligation to protect Mergen had become a convenient fiction for both men. I should have recognized that a long time ago, I who have made such a big deal out of brotherhood for so many years. Tydei bustled up. We set off after Run-Must. I said, "Sing, you should let me take a look at that leg. It should have healed faster than it has."
"It'll mend fine once I get some real rest, sir, and I believe we expect to stay here for some time."
What good would that do if the man refused to take the opportunity to rest? I could have Tobo knock him into a coma. Run-Must led us to a room barely big enough to fit a dozen people. Sleepy and Sovereign, the Prabhrindra Dra and his sister, Tobo and Sara, were there already. So was the handsome stranger. "Sit," Sleepy said. Then she got straight to the point. "This is Aridatha Singh." Beside me, Lady winced, recognizing the name and thinking of her trophies. Aridatha commands the city battalions in Taglios. He, the great general, and Gopal Singh, who commands the Greys, form the triumvirate who are running Taglios while the protector is out of town. Aridatha tells me that he and they, the protector's top henchmen, have decided they need to get rid of her. From one side, in back, Willow Swan grumbled, "Gopal Singh is a general now? He was a damned sergeant when he worked for me." Aridatha responded, "The protector prides herself on her ability to recognize outstanding talent." A joke of sorts had passed between the two. I guess you had to have been part of the situation to follow it. While we sat around with our mouths hanging open, looking intelligent, Sleepy told the outsider, "These people are here to offer their advice. That's Croker. He was the Liberator once upon a time. That's Lady. That's Mergen. They've all led the company at some time. The others you'll recall from the last time we met." She passed over Tidei, which lent him an air of mystery. Nor did she introduce the Prabhrindra Dra. I asked, "Did Mogaba send you?" "I volunteered, because your captain knew me, and because your company has no personal grievance with me." Lady stirred. She was willing to invent one. Sleepy said, "It would seem that there are limits even Mogaba refuses to exceed, and Soulcatcher has managed to discover them." Aridatha said, "You have ancient grievances with the great general. I want you to know that he isn't an evil man. He is an obsessed man, though his obsession has weathered away with age. He's realized that history won't record his name on the roll of great conquerors. There's no longer time. He hasn't entirely made his peace with that, but he does see that it's his own fault. Because of his untimely defection during the siege of Dejagore, he has been forced to serve a procession of deranged and incompetent masters. But that's of no moment now. Between us, he, Gopal, and I have concluded that Taglios should be spared any more torment by the Protector. She's like a deadly rot. She's destroying everything slowly, even our religions and culture, and the only force able to put an end to that is the Black Company." Mergen suggested, "You guys could whack her yourselves. She's not immortal, and she trusts you, as much as she trusts anybody. That gets you close enough. That plan was in place even before you people resurfaced. But she stayed away from the city since the beginning of that crisis. Her messages to the great general all affirm her determination to keep after you until she's accounted for every member of the Black Company personally. She was extremely put out because so many people who were supposed to be dead started turning up alive." "Believe me, I know how exasperating that is," Lady said. "For 20 years I chased the deceiver Narayan Singh. That man had more lives than a cat." Aridatha caught the past tense. "Has the living saint of the deceivers passed to his reward then?" "He got away from me through the only exit he had left." Lady sounded extremely bitter, like she thought Singh had beaten her by cheating blatantly. Her hatred of Narayan was stronger than I had suspected. "Then that's one distraction that no longer needs concern us." "Incorrect," Sleepy said, reclaiming control. "The Daughter of Night is still out there, and Kina still hopes to bring on the Year of the Skulls. Whatever else happens, Kina and her followers still have to be managed. Tell my associates why we should trust anything you tell us, Aridatha." "I am, of course, damned to walk in the shadow of a man I met only once in my life, after I was a grown man, and then for only a few minutes, several years ago, in your presence. That's the legacy of the deceivers. The cult destroys trust. My answer is, all men should be judged by one standard— their behavior, by the deeds they do. The gesture of good faith I have to make in this instance is, I think, generous." Sleepy interrupted.
Aridatha has a brother who lives in Jaipur, under an assumed name. This brother, real name Sugriva, is going to help us take the city. He'll scout out the best gate for us to get at in the middle of the night. We'll use it to prance in and take over before anyone can put up a fight.
I opened my mouth to argue, but stopped before anything stupid came out. Sleepy's mind was made up. All I could do was my best to make sure everything worked out right.
Soulcatcher has an army between here and there, one that outnumbers us, I hear. And one that's little better than a rabble, according to Aridatha. Some of the poorer soldiers are armed only with hammers, pitchforks, sickles, and such.
A guy goes away for a few decades, everything turns to shit, I said. I had everybody tall enough to reach his mother's hand armed up once upon a time. What happened to all those weapons?
Riverwalker explained. When the Protector took over, times got so bad that almost anybody with anything to sell sold it. Weapons were a glut on the market. The steel got forged into other things.
And the Protector didn't care, Aridatha said. The great general finally gave up trying to make her see the point of maintaining arsenals in peacetime. I think it won't be long now until she understands what he was talking about.
Sleepy told us.
It isn't necessary to trust Aridatha or Mogaba to test Jaikur's defenses. We're expected to swing west toward the Nagia River. We'll make a show of doing just that. But Blade, with the light cavalry, will split off the rear of the column and loop back around eastward. The hidden folk will find a route along which the horsemen can approach Jaikur unobserved. In the meantime, the main force will turn again and head for the rock road north of Jaikur. That ought to stir up an ant's nest and make Soulcatcher forget Jaikur completely for a few days.
Why had Sleepy bothered calling the rest of us in? She had it all worked out already, and pretty soundly, I thought.
Tobo said, "We do have a more immediate problem than that, Sleepy. You brought General Singh in during the reanimation ceremony, and he's been seen around camp. It's inevitable that some of our outside visitors will be Soulcatcher's creatures, and it's possible one of them recognized him."
Sleepy admitted, "I didn't think fast enough. I'm open to corrective suggestions."
"I'm already working on it, but I do want to warn you. I don't think I can be 100% successful in identifying them and cutting them off."
"Then you'd better consider what would be the best way to warn the other conspirators in Taglios, hadn't you?"
Aridatha said, "Gopal and the great general won't be taken unawares. The Protector possesses no means of traveling faster than the rumor of her coming. When she heads for Taglios, they'll know before she gets there, and what she brings with her will betray her intentions."
I nodded. The reasoning seemed sound, and you did have to be really sneaky to outfox Mogaba.
Soulcatcher was not sneaky these days. She had developed the habit of just bullying straight ahead because she was the biggest power around. Sleepy elected to assume a stance which made it look like we were just going to sit and rest. But Tobo scouted the country north of Garhanes in ever greater detail, sometimes even going out in person when he went flying with Shukrat. The two of them were getting very chummy. In private, I observed, "This is getting distinctly weird. We're allies with Soulcatcher against our daughter and Kina. We're allies with the traitor Mogaba against your sister. We're allies with a demigod whose price for supporting us is that we murder him."
Lady chuckled weakly.
"You did say it has a mythic ring."
"You know something? It's got me scared."
She stared at nothing, waiting for me to explain.
"Scared in a generalized way, not scared like when we're in a fight. Scared of the shape the future might take." I had a bad, bad feeling. Because on the surface, everything looked just too marvelous for the Black Company.
Chapter 59
With the Middle Army. When guests arrived.
the goblin creature proved difficult to catch. What should have taken just a few days took 2 weeks, and in the end necessitated Soulcatcher's personal intervention, with, to her chagrin, considerable coaching from the shadowy cat thing she could never quite see and never quite ambush and bind to her own service. In the meantime, she amused herself with the girl. The Daughter of Night was imprisoned in a cage inside Soulcatcher's tent. That was the largest and most ostentatious tent in the Midway camp. The girl had been stripped naked, then had been decorated with a variety of chains and charms. She would not be guarded by or even approached by anyone male. Soulcatcher knew only too well how men could be manipulated by the women of her blood. Though the girl did not seem interested in listening, Soulcatcher said,
"To this day I'm not quite sure how you and that old man managed to get away from me. But I have some suspicions, and it won't happen again. You're far too important to your mother to be running around loose." The voice Soulcatcher selected was annoyingly pedantic.
The girl did not respond. She was alone in her own reality. This was not her first time as a prisoner of someone who planned to use her. She could be patient. Her moment would come. Someone would slip up. An impressionable guard would be assigned. Something. Somewhere, sometime, she would have an opportunity to deceive someone into loving her long enough to want to set her free. The girl's continued indifference pricked Soulcatcher into trying to hurt her with news she had wanted to reserve.
"He's dead, you know. Your old man, Narayan Singh. He was strangled. They threw his body in a cesspit."
That blow did strike home, but after an initial flinch and a brief black look, the Daughter of Night lowered her eyes and settled back into her pose of patient indifference. Soulcatcher laughed.
"Your freak goddess has abandoned you."
To which the girl offered her only spoken response since her capture.
"All their days are numbered."
Which was like a slap in Soulcatcher's face. It was one of those slogans Black Company-inspired graffitists had used to taunt her for years. Soulcatcher snatched a whip, flailed away without doing the girl much harm. The cage itself prevented that. Someone shouted for Soulcatcher's attention from outside the entrance to her tent. In that respect, her soldiers were well trained. They did not bother her with trivia. Responding, Soulcatcher found a gaggle of soldiers with a dead man on a crude litter. The corpse was twisted. Its features were severely distorted. Raindrops slid off the ruined face like tears. "You," she said, picking a man.
"Tell it."
A cavalryman covered with mud. He must have been on picket duty.
"This man came up from the south. He gave the proper recognition signs. He told us that he was bringing you important news about traitors, but wouldn't say anything else."
"He arrived healthy. How did he get this way?"
"Just before we got to camp, he stood up in his stirrups and screamed. His horse reared and threw him. After he hit the ground, he shuddered and twitched and made gurgling noises, trying to scream, and then he died."
"Traitors?"
No doubt there would be many of those to pay off before this played out. These situations brought them out from under every rock and bush.
"That's all he said, ma'am."
"Bring him inside. It's possible I can still get a little something out of him. Be careful where you track your mud."
She stepped aside, even held the flap for the soldiers. Reluctantly, a few found courage enough to bring the body forward. Soulcatcher's soldiers shared a common opinion that it was not good to catch the protector's eye. These stepped carefully, leaving as little mud and moisture as possible. In a merry young voice, Soulcatcher observed,
"You must all have mothers."
Soulcatcher had the corpse partially stripped, disassembling its apparel thread by thread, when there was another disturbance outside the tent entrance. Irked, she responded, hoping this would be the news she had been awaiting so long, that Goblin had been captured at last. As she was about to open up, she caught motion from the corner of her eye.
she spun. For an instant she thought she glimpsed a tiny man, maybe 8 inches tall, ducking down behind the corpse. The racket outside remained insistent. It was not the news she wanted. The soldiers there, they always came in groups, pushed one of their number forward.
"A courier just came in, ma'am. The enemy is on the move again. Westward."
Mogaba had called it right then.
"When did this start?"
"The courier will be with you in a minute, ma'am, with dispatches. He had some physical needs he couldn't put off before he could see you. But the command staff insisted you get the main news immediately."
In a casual tone, Soulcatcher observed, "The drizzle seems to be letting up."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Get that courier here as fast as possible."
"Yes, ma'am."
The reports from the south did indeed have the rested Black Company forces moving westward, but not on the track previously anticipated. Part of their journey would have to be made without the benefit of roads, over rough terrain. Soulcatcher said,
"They must be striking for Ballychore by the shortest route. Why? Can anyone tell me what's special about Ballychore?"
Soulcatcher controlled a sprawling empire she knew only a little about. After an extended silence, someone tentatively suggested,
"That's the farthest upriver heavy barge traffic travels. Cargoes have to be portaged and loaded on smaller boats or onto wagons."
Someone else recalled,
"There's some kind of problem with rocks in the river. A whatchamacallit? A cataract. The Liberator once ordered a canal built around it, but the project was abandoned."
A couple of pokes in the ribs were necessary before the speaker recalled who was responsible for the neglect of public works in recent times. Soulcatcher did not respond, however. She concentrated on the transport idea. A large portion of the company had barged up the Nagir River after fleeing Taglios 5 years ago. Could this new captain be in a rut? Or was she thinking she could catch Taglios by surprise from the riverside, where there were no walls and no defensive works, and the peoples of those poorer quarters tended toward nostalgic recollections of the Prabhrindra Dra, the Radisha, and even the Liberator? Soulcatcher asked,
"Does anyone happen to know how long it takes to get a barge down the Nagir, through the delta channels and upriver to Taglios?"
She knew barges manned by veteran crews traveled day and night, unlike soldiers afoot or on horseback. Another disturbance at the entrance arose before anyone produced a reliable answer. The drizzle had ended, she discovered, yet the men demanding attention were covered with mud, and they had brought her a present.
"For me? And it's not even my birthday."
Goblin was a present who looked way the worse for use. He was bound and gagged. His head and hands were wrapped in rags as well. His captors had been determined to take no chances. Soulcatcher gloated.
"He stumbled into one of my traps, didn't he?"
"Yes, he did, ma'am."
There were hundreds of those out there, taking many forms. Soulcatcher had begun to put them out as soon as it had become evident that the new, improved goblin could evade the best efforts of her soldiers.
"He's still alive, isn't he?"
If he was dead, her concern that he might have allowed himself to be caught would slide down her list of worries.
"Your instructions were perfectly clear, ma'am."
Soulcatcher memorized that man's face. He was mocking her behind a mask of rectitude. She preferred open defiance. That she could crush without mystifying anyone.
"Take the mask and gag off. Set him up over here."
The Daughter of Night, Soulcatcher noted, was interested enough to forget to hide her interest. She could not know the little wizard's significance, could she? No. Impossible. The girl was just doing what she did whenever anything happened inside the tent. She paid attention because she might learn something useful. Soulcatcher waited until she judged that Goblin was sufficiently recovered. She told him,
"Your former brothers really don't like turncoats, do they?"
Goblin stared at her with eyes colder, deeper, and more remote than those of the Daughter of Night. He did not reply. She stepped closer. Her mask was just a foot from his face. She purred.
"They came to me for help settling your account."
Goblin twitched but remained silent. He did try to look around. He smiled when he glimpsed the Daughter of Night. Soulcatcher said,
"They told me all about it, little man. They told me what you are now. They expect me to just kill you because of what you did to my foot. They really just want you dead."
She rubbed her gloved hands together.
"But I think I'm going to be a lot cruder."
She giggled.
"All their days are numbered,"
Goblin said in a whisper. The voice, borrowing the taunt, only vaguely resembled that of the man who had gone down into the earth to challenge the Dark Mother.
"Some more closely than others."
Soulcatcher's voice was old and emotionless. Her right hand lashed out, sliced across Goblin's face. Blades, a half-inch long on the ends of her fingers, destroyed his eyes and the bridge of his nose. He shrieked, at first as much in surprise as in pain. The Protector turned on the men who had brought the prisoner in.
"Bring me another cage like the one the brat is in."
The cage did in fact exist already. Such had been her certainty that she would capture Goblin. The blacksmith had orders to create three more, suitable for housing her sister, her sister's husband, and that treacherous Willow Swan. Later, in Taglios, she meant to work with a glass blower to bottle them all so they could be displayed outside the entrance to her palace. They would be kept alive and fed until they drowned in their own ordure. Such was the fate that the Dominator often bestowed upon his most important enemies in his time. Chapter 60 Garhonis, Tobo and the Voroshk. The Howler certainly kept busy. He completed his first functional four-passenger flying carpet 2 days after the soldiers marched westward. Garhonis seemed deserted, though there were enough of us around to bloody a bunch of noses the morning the former tenant took a notion to steal his home back. Sleepy had a dozen carpets on order, from single-rider scouts to a monster she hoped would carry 20 soldiers. I do not know who she expected to fly them. Only Howler and Tobo, and possibly the Voroshk, had the power to manage the things. I insisted that we have a couple of modest-sized carpets first. Those should not take too long to make, and would be the size most useful to us right away. And since I was in charge of the left behinds and the De Jagere strike, I got what I wanted. Well, I got the one carpet. Tobo had the flying post thing figured out, too. Both Shukrat and Arcana seemed eager to get along now. One or the other would allow Tobo to borrow her post when he wanted to run out to visit Sleepy, which he did by night so he would not be seen from the ground. I never felt comfortable when he did that. We had too many potentially unpleasant and unfriendly people back here in the manor, including a lot of hostages from the leading families of the region. Both Magadan and Gromovol were increasingly determined not to be won over, each for his own reasons. I told Magadan, "I'd be tempted to send you two home just so I don't have to worry about what's going on behind my back." I was not worried, really. Tobo's supernatural friends saw everything. Magadan told me, "I don't want to go home. Home no longer exists. I want to be free." "Sure. You, Voroshk, showed what you can do when you're free. I've spent my life killing people like you. That's people who believe it's their destiny to make slaves out of people like me. I'm in a war with another one of them right now. I'm not about to cut you loose and let you start making people's lives miserable, too." None of which was absolutely true, but it did sound good, and Magadan bought it. Some. The part that really was true, that I would kill him before I turned him loose on the world. That was the moment when he decided he might want to go home after all. From then on, he brought that possibility up each time we crossed paths.
The hidden folk said he was sincere. He was trying to get the other kids to go along with swapping what knowledge they had for an escort back across the place of glittering stone. Lady did not believe it. She thought we should put him and Gromovald down because of the trouble they could cause. My sweetie has a very direct approach to problem-solving. Sometimes I do find what little conscience I retain a damnable handicap. Howler, though, did successfully work his way out of the top 10 on my shit list. Tobo's appeal to Shvetya had resulted in word from the golem saying he did have the ability to intervene in Howler's screaming and shrinking problems. Shvetya did not have much of a reputation as a liar, so even Howler took him at his word, after which the smelly little wizard became extremely cooperative. Though we still had no cause to trust his long-run intentions, nor he any call to trust ours, either. Lady cornered Tobo.
"We have a dangerous situation here, and like a pet cobra it's going to bite us someday. We have to do something."
The boy sounded puzzled.
"What are you talking about? Something about what?"
"Those Varoshk. They aren't as strong or as bright as we first thought, but there are four of them and only one of you."
"But they're not going to—"
"Pardon me for being an old cynic," I said. "Magadan keeps telling me, in so many words, that he wants to be anywhere that isn't here with us, and there's at least the implication that he'll do whatever it takes if we don't help him go home. And Gromovall is going to be trouble eventually, because his personality requires it. If you go out to visit Sleepy, or just on a flying date, the rest of us are stuck here with no better hope than the Howler."
"And speaking of flying," Lady said,
"don't you ever go out with both of those girls again. Hush! You're only familiar with the women you've grown up around. I'm telling you right now that Arcana is exactly like Magadan, but she has one more weapon than he does, and she means to use it to cloud your mind. But Shukrat, I'm not sure about. There's a chance Shukrat is exactly what she seems." I agreed. The kid was likable, and according to Tobo, the hidden folk agreed. They offered no reason not to trust her. Tobo was not used to arguing with anybody but his mother, even when he thought he was right. He did not want to think ill of Arcana, but would not fight us. Lady demanded,
"So how do we make sure of them? You have to think of something before we move against Dejagare. We'll be scattered, distracted, and extremely vulnerable then. And because you spend time with the girls, out amongst the rest of us, all four will know what's going on. They can plan accordingly."
Again, Tobo did not get a word in before I said,
"I would be."
Lady reminded him,
"You've never been a prisoner." "Now there's a joke. I was born a prisoner. A prisoner of a prophecy by an old woman who died years before I was born. A prisoner of the expectations of all you people. Gods, I wish Hong Tre was wrong and I could have been a normal kid."
"There aren't any normal kids, Tobo," I told him. "Just kids who fake it better than the rest of us do."
"And that name, Tobo, that was my baby name. Why does everybody still call me that? Why didn't we ever have a ceremony to give me a grown-up name?"
Nguyen Bao do that, and Tobo was years past the appropriate birthday. Lady told him,
"You'll have to take that up with Uncle Doge. Meantime, the other thing needs addressing right now. Blade is moving already. In 3 more days, Sleepy will curl back to the northeast, and it'll be too late to stop anything. I want to be sure that we don't get stabbed in the back just when things get exciting."
An hour after we nagged him, Tobo asked Shukrat to go flying. He borrowed Arcana's log. Arcana was not pleased. When an hour later she told me Magadan had said he did not mind if she used his post to join Shukrat and Tobo, I told her, "But I mind. If you need to talk to Tobo, do it when he gets back." Arcana was the brightest of the Varoshk. She recognized that things were tightening up. When Tobo did return, he stayed just long enough to round up Magadan. He took Magadan flying.
It was the first time Magadan had been aloft since he had entered our keeping. He did not appear excited, which I would have expected. They returned within a half hour. Magadan's hand-me-downs, appropriated from Garhane's former occupants, were ragged. He looked like he had been in a fight, and the other guy had kicked his butt. A good long way. Tobo gave instructions for Magadan to be isolated, then found Arcana and took her for a fly. The Ice Queen, I noted, had replaced her confiscated robes with native garb that served her to considerable visual advantage. "Down, boy," Lady said. "It's a good thing I didn't run into her before I met you, isn't it?" That earned me a not entirely playful swat. Arcana came back looking rougher than Magadan had, and she was not smiling. Tobo had Arcana put in with Magadan. He collected Gromovol. Gromovol was not interested in going anywhere with Tobo. Tobo insisted. They were not gone long. Once they returned, Tobo had the Varashk returned to their quarters. He gathered their flying posts in the main hall. Lady and I joined him. I asked, "What was that all about?" "I took them out and dueled with them, except for Shukrat." I stopped Lady before she explained, probably at great length, how unsmart doing that could have proven. Sometimes she could fuss as much as Sara. I said, "I'm sure there was a reason. I wanted to find out just how much we really do have to fear from them." "And?" "They're frauds. The only power they really have is what they draw from their post and their clothing. Without those, even Shukrat isn't as powerful as One Eye was at the end. Gromovol is about Uncle Doge's equal. Lady, even as weak as you are right now, you could manage any of them but Shukrat." I snorted. "I guess that would explain why Gromovol's pop was anxious to get the kids back. Were most of the Voroshk limited talents? Were most of them carried by a few strong members of the clan?" "I'd guess that's likely. The point, though, is that for right now, there's a better chance our Voroshk will attack us with knives than with sorcery." He looked at us, saw no obvious eagerness to embrace his theory. "Don't you think that if they had any real power, they would have used it to try to escape?" I realized that he was upset. He had believed he was making friends with the Voroshk. Our worries had led him to test that, and he had learned that his friends were not as close as he had hoped. "You're telling us we don't have to kill them to be safe," Lady said. "That, too. You have the unknown shadows at your command, and you didn't figure this out until today." Lady can find something to suspect in everything. "I would suggest we retire and settle down somewhere where we do not have to worry all the time, but she would suspect me of ulterior motives." "I've thought it for a long time," he admitted sullenly. "But the hidden folk can't report things that they don't hear. The Varashk don't discuss their weaknesses, or much of anything else, actually. Because of their present situation, nobody likes anybody very much anymore." I said, "I didn't want to kill them anyway. Maybe I'd like to thump Gromovol a little now and then, but..." "So that's settled. Heck, turn them loose if you want. Once they've had a dose of the real world, they'll come back. Meantime, let me get to work on these things." Lady asked, "You finally found their secret. You can make more." "I've learned how to change who they recognize as their master. None of the Varashk know how the posts are made. They're not even sure of the theory behind them. I know more than they do, just because I've studied the things. I don't yet know how they pull their magical power, but I don't know how I do that either. Someday I will know, but it'll be a long, slow, dangerous process finding out. They're booby-trapped." I told him, "Life is booby-trapped, kid." As we left the hallway, Lady was speculating on whether the original Varashk had invented their magics, or if they had just stolen them from an ingenious but unwary predecessor. I did not care, so long as no Varashk made my life more difficult than it already was. Chapter 61 The Taglian Territories.
Night Flyers in Dejagere. Three flying posts formed the goose flock formation. Tobo had the point, with Willow Swan riding Pillion. Swan was in the throes of an apparently severe religious relapse, muttering a continuous, polysyllabic, one-word prayer. With his attitude toward heights, he would be bruising Tobo by hanging on so tight. His eyes would be closed so intently that he would have muscle cramps all the way back to his ankles. Lady and Shukrat flew the other posts. Lady had Aridatha Singh aboard behind her. Shukrat carried Uncle Doge. Mergen, Tai Day, and I shared the flying carpet with the Howler, whose shrieks were being contained inside a big glass bowl sort of thing Lady had put over his head. It worked well enough to save trouble with people who did not know we were coming. Mergen and Tai Day were along only because Sara had to be placated. She did not want her baby going into harm's way alone. People everywhere were irked because the boy's father and uncle had had to be flown back to Garhanis before the raid could be launched. But Sara had been stubborn and loud, and Sleepy had given in rather than lose a friend. Sara's recollections of and fears of Dejagere remained abiding and debilitating. I hoped Mergen and Tai Day handled it better, though at takeoff time Mergen had been sweaty, pallid, shaking, and appeared to be having trouble breathing, and Tai Day had seemed more self-engrossed than ever. I had spoken to each alone and had tried telling each that I was counting on him to keep an eye on the other and carry him if the emotional strain became too much. I have found that assigning major external responsibilities like that can get many of my brothers through times of deep emotional stress. Howler kept the carpet in the pocket of the formation. We moved northward at a pace that created a cold wind strong enough to pull the tears out of my eyes. Mergen and I occupied the carpet's rear corners. I told him, "I'd forgotten just how much I don't like this. Why didn't I send some of those eager young bucks from Sien?" "Because you're just like every other recent captain of the company. You gotta have your pointy nose right in the middle of things so you can make sure things get done your way." Up ahead, Tobo lifted the shutter on a red lantern. He winked the light several times. There was an answering signal from the ground, miles off our track and much farther forward than I expected. Blade and the cavalry had made good time and were already in the ring of hills surrounding Dejagere. The moon would rise in an hour. It would provide the light they needed to filter through the hills and descend the inner slope. We passed over the rim and discovered the scattered lights of Dejagere. We slowed to a crawl. The flying posts gathered together. Aridatha tried to explain to Tobo where we needed to go. I told Mergen, "You should have gone with Tobo. You know Dejagere better than anyone else."
"Dejagere 25 years ago, maybe. It's a whole new city since my day. Aridatha belongs with him. It's only been weeks since he was there."
Few details could be distinguished by starlight, but as we moved closer, the walls and main buildings matched my recollections almost exactly. The logs formed up in a line astern, with Lady and Aridatha leading. Howler fell in behind. We resumed moving. 10 minutes later, we were on the ground. 5 minutes after that, Aridatha hustled us into his brother's shop. Sugriva Singh seemed to be a shorter and older version of Aridatha. He had done well for himself. He had the whole downstairs of a building for his business and everything above for his family, none of whom were ever in evidence. Sugriva's past good fortune assured his deep displeasure at our invasion. All of a sudden he had 10 villains in amongst the vegetables, and only his brother and the bountiful little blonde did not look willing to roast him for a prank. He had a great deal to lose here, and maybe more to lose if he did not cooperate. The Strangler cult was hated in the extreme in Dejagere. Just a whisper about his relationship to the living saint of the deceivers would destroy him and just about anyone who had ever spoken to him. Aridatha dispensed with introductions.
Sugriva did not need to know his visitors. Chances were he recognized a few of us anyway. Haridatha told his brother, "Our father is dead. He was murdered a few weeks ago. Strangled." Sugriva was the elder by a decade. He remembered the Narayan Singh who had sold vegetables and doted on his children before the invasion of the Shadow Masters. He was stricken as Haridatha had not been stricken.
"And that should be no surprise, should it? Is that what you mean?"
Sugriva said through tears that might have been due as much to rage as to pain. He needed a few minutes to collect himself. To his credit, Sugriva Singh did not rail against the inevitable. He understood exactly how his arm was being twisted, and though events were not going to proceed quite like Haridatha had led him to expect during his previous visit, he chose to cooperate. He wanted to get it over as fast as he could. Then he would pray that the new administration would be as indifferent to him as he was to the one presently in place. Things were not exactly working out the way Haridatha had hoped they would, either. Sugriva said,
"You haven't chosen the best night to do this. The moon is going to expose anyone moving toward the city from outside."
Tobo chuckled. "You might be surprised. The night is our friend, Brother Sugriva."
"I rather expect you'll find that my father believed the same thing, young man."
"And his father's son?" Sugriva had been unhappy, even angry when we turned up, but not really surprised. What kind of vegetable dealer was not surprised to be wakened in the night, inside a city that closed its gates with fanatical devotion when the sun's lower limb touched the western hilltops? Could Haridatha's big brother be some sort of crook? Haridatha told his brother,
"The reason we're troubling you is that we don't know how the gatekeeping is managed."
"You told me before. I looked into it. There's a company of soldiers assigned to each gate. The west gate is the most closely controlled because it sees more traffic than the other three put together."
One of Dejagore's quirks was that most of today's roads to the city joined outside it, to the west, so there was not much traffic elsewhere. The north and south gates were used only by people involved in agriculture and its produce.
"The east gate looks like it should be the easiest to seize and control," Sugriva said.
A true road did connect with the east gate, but there was little out that way but a few distant villages.
"The guards are slackers at all levels. None of them are natives. None of them are old enough to remember the last time Jaipur was attacked."
Sugriva had adopted the local accent and the local name for the city when he had assumed a Dejagoran name. The trouble with the east gate was that Blade was west of Dejagore, but he was well ahead of schedule. There was time before sunrise, if he hustled. Tobo suggested,
"Lady, why don't you go tell Blade that it has to be the east gate?"
"Because I'm going to be getting dressed." Widowmaker and Lifetaker were coming to the party. They had been away for far too long. Half a minute later, Shukrat said,
"I guess it's time to find out if you can really trust me, Tobo."
I jumped in before the boy could speak.
"I suppose so. Tell Blade not to waste time. We need as much of the night as we can get, and we won't stay unnoticed long once we start. Tell him we'll be waiting when he gets to the gate."
A smile tickled Shukrat's freckled, almost pudgy face. She bounced up onto her toes and gave Tobo a peck on the cheek. Bold, bold behavior by any standard in this part of the world. They must do things differently among the Varoshk. She bounced away. Tobo was completely flustered. I grinned till Lady poked me in the ribs. Evidently I was enjoying the bouncing part a little too much. Mergen said, "I suggest we get to work here, folks. I don't want to be inside these walls a minute longer than I have to." He was holding it together, but the strain was obvious. Tai Day was frazzled, too, and with even better reason. A lot of people very close to him had died here during the siege. No matter how tough a man pretends to be, such losses gnaw at his soul, unless he is not human at all.
The man has a point, I said. Start getting ready.
Lady and I had the most to do. We had a big show to put on. We retreated into a small, separate room, colder than the main shop. As we strove to turn ourselves into walking nightmares, I asked, "Hun, have you really got that post-riding stuff figured out?"
"It isn't that hard, except for staying on. Any idiot could do it. There are some little black rods and slidey things you move around. You go up or down, or faster or slower, or whatever, when you do. Why?"
"It occurs to me that it might be better for us, and him both, if we got Aridatha back to Taglios. He's been gone a long time. Mogaba needs to have him back where he can show him off before news of tonight's business gets around." She did not stop donning the Lifetaker armor, but did look at me in a way that I do not see often. It was like she was looking right through me, at all the secret places inside. It was frightening sometimes.
"All right, we'll have to move fast if I'm going to be aloft before daylight."
"Will the log make it that far?" Not knowing how those things worked, I did not know what you might have to feed it, like a horse. The posts did seem to work on a different principle than Howler's flying carpets, which required a strong-willed, powerful sorcerer to drive them. They demanded his undivided attention every moment they were aloft.
"I'm sure it will. What do you want me to tell Mogaba?"
The long-time taunt, "My brother unforgiven," came to mind, along with, "All their days are numbered." But this was not the time.